It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. State Democratic lawmakers reintroduce a clean repeal of the state's 1849 abortion ban, while Republicans roll out a bill creating rape and incest exceptions. We look at the path forward on abortion with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kelda Royce is here, State Senator representing the 26th District in Madison. State Senator Royce, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be with you, Kate.
Well, let's begin with legislation that you and other Democrats announced yesterday alongside Governor Evers to repeal the state's 19th century abortion ban. Tell us why you're out front on this bill.
Well, we believe that women and not politicians are the only ones who should make those personal decisions about our own bodies and lives and health. Abortion is basic health care. Approximately 1 in 4 American women will need that. And it's overwhelming that Wisconsinites and Americans are pro-choice and want to see the rights that we had under Roe v. Wade restored.
Is reintroducing this bill a waste of time or attention when it faces slim chances in a Republican-controlled legislature?
I don't think it's ever a waste of time to stand up for people's rights and freedoms and to do the right thing. The fact is that if our state were not so severely gerrymandered, this archaic language would already have been repealed from the books because there would be political accountability. It is really important that we keep this issue in the news, front and center, so that Wisconsinites know that there is a clear contrast between Democrats who are fighting for their rights and Republicans who are actually working to make the 1849 language even more extreme, and they want to be attacking birth control and fertility treatment next.
I would just put a pin on that. I want to ask you about the governor calling this bill a clean repeal. What does he mean by that?
I think what he's talking about is before June 24th of last year, before the Dobbs decision came down, women in Wisconsin had the legal right to choose abortion. Now, is it true that abortion was out of reach for many people, that it was difficult to access, there were not as many abortion providers as we need? Yes, of course. However, women had the legal right. And then after Dobbs came down, abortion became unavailable virtually overnight. So all we're talking about is restoring the rights we had under Roe v. Wade, not changing anything else about the way that abortion has been heavily regulated in our state.
There is sentiment that this bill seeks to establish abortion access without court input. Can you explain that a little bit further, what that aspect means?
Well, generally, people's rights should be protected under the Constitution. We shouldn't put people's fundamental humanity up for a vote. And I actually think if you read our state constitution, the very first article talks about equality. So I think there are lots of reasons to believe that abortion rights are protected by the constitution of our state. That said, I think it's also very important that as legislators, we be responsive to what Wisconsinites need. And I hear from people all the time that if we want Wisconsin to thrive, we need to make the state a welcoming place for people. We want to make sure that young people move here and that we retain our best and brightest young workers who right now are leaving the state in droves. We need to retain healthcare professionals. We particularly have a crisis of OBGYN access in huge swaths of the state where there's just not enough providers. And the moves by Republican legislatures to further criminalize healthcare provision are only making Wisconsin more hostile to the very people we need to attract and retain.
Assembly Republicans last week proposed creating exceptions in the state abortion ban for cases involving sexual assault and incest. Governor Evers vowed to veto such a bill if ever it reached his desk. What is your position on creating the exceptions in state law?
Well, let's be clear. That wasn't an actual bill that was being produced in good faith. That was a very cynical and desperate attempt to manipulate the media and the electorate. Republicans see that their Supreme Court candidate is lagging, and they want to do anything to appear less extreme to try to get him over the finish line on April 4th. And, within just a few hours, the Senate president said, yep, that bill's DOA. It's not going to go anywhere. It won't come to the floor of the Senate. And other Republican members were at the same time introducing legislation to actually criminalize free speech relating to abortion. So making it illegal for doctors at UW Health, say, or legislators like me, who are state employees, to even give accurate information about abortion. So the Republican Party is very much not on the same page about this, and the majority of those folks want to see even more restrictions.
Talking about abortion policy and regulation, the path forward with Kelda Royce, Democratic State Senator representing the 26th District in Madison. You can join in the conversation. Your questions and comments welcome. 800-642-1234. Last week, we saw Wyoming become the first state to specifically ban medication abortion pills. Are medication abortion pills legal here in Wisconsin under the state's 1849 ban?
Well, currently, there are no penalties for women who are self-managing abortion. And you can certainly go to websites like aidaccess.org and order medication abortion. It is highly safe, safer than Tylenol, safer than Viagra. It's easily accessible, costs about $100, and you can even order it before you're pregnant to just have on hand. That said, there have been Republican efforts all over this country to criminalize women for seeking abortion care, not just the health care provider. And so, I think that's why it really matters who's in charge. It matters, who wins the Supreme Court race, because all of these issues are going to continue to be fought over for the years to come because the Supreme Court turned its back on women and overturned Roe v. Wade.
Let's bring on a call now. Lori is joining us from Shawano. Lori, hi, what's on your mind?
So we have not had orphanages since the 60s. Part of that probably because the pill was legalized and women were no longer having 10 to 20 kids. But in, say, 10 years, when we've got more kids than common sense, what is the Republican plan for those kids, especially the ones that are unhealthy, the ones that are born to older women, because 35 and over, they tend to have more problems, more issues with their fetuses, and girls who have been raped by a family member. There's going to be all these unhealthy kids. We already have foster kids who aren't being adopted, and now we're going to have all these other kids. And
Lori,
I wish.
thank you. And I want to be able to toss this scenario back to State Senator Royce for comment. Go ahead.
Oh, I think the larger point is really important, and that's that Republicans are doing nothing to address the shameful racial disparities we have in infant maternal mortality here in Wisconsin. They can't even get their act together to expand Medicaid for women postpartum. So there, we have a terrible social safety net. We don't have paid family leave. We do not do enough to ensure that childcare is affordable. So even for people who want a parent, and I'm a parent, I've got five kids and stepkids, and I know how hard it is. Republicans have really nothing to offer parents to make our lives easier and to help our economy thrive. And yet, they also want to deprive us of the very means to plan our families, to space our pregnancies. And that hypocrisy, I think, is clearly on display.
Well, setting aside abortion just for a moment, what legislation aimed at supporting families, supporting children, could you back with Republicans in this session?
Well, I think, the question is what legislation supporting families would any Republican back? Governor Evers' budget has so many wonderful things in it to invest in our kids. From funding for K-12 to access to mental health care to the Child Care Counts program, which, by the way, if that funding goes away, we stand to lose maybe a quarter of the child care slots in the state. And that'll have a devastating effect on our economy and our workforce. What about paid family leave? Being pregnant and giving birth is no picnic, and people's bodies need time to recover, and families deserve time to bond with their new babies or take time off to care for a loved one who's ill.
Do you think you could find consensus on those types of issues with your colleagues across the aisle?
I wish I could. And then Republicans in other states are much more inclined to do things like, for instance, expanding Medicaid. But Republicans in Wisconsin, and I think it's because we are so gerrymandered, they do not have the same incentive to come to the table and cooperate because they face no accountability from voters, and they're in a way victims of their own success with gerrymandering. Their caucus has become so extreme that they're, deeply divided, and too many of them are really focused on, for instance, even removing the very narrow life exception from the 1849 law and criminalizing free speech about abortion. And they're not interested in engaging on these kind of basic problem-solving issues that most voters would hope the legislature would work on.
Bring in Ben in Rhinelander now. Ben, hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is not so much on the aspect of abortion, yes or no. Somebody that's middle of the road on it, that doesn't get swayed one way or the other. Mine is on the funding for abortion. Why should my tax dollars be sent to something that I'm not for? Now, whether it's passed or not passed and the legislation changes, my biggest hang up is the funding and the use of tax dollars for a program that I may or may not believe in.
Ben, thank you. State Senator Royce, could you hear that? Tax dollars going to something Ben doesn't believe in.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Ben. In Wisconsin, taxpayer dollars have been prohibited from funding abortion for many years. I think that is unfortunate because abortion is basic health care that, one in four women will need. Women should not be treated like criminals when they need to access abortion. And every single one of us loves someone who will need abortion, whether we know it or not. And abortion shouldn't be something that's available only for people with means, only with people that can find transportation or childcare. About 60% of women who have abortions are already mothers, so they know what it is to care for a child. Our tax dollars go to support a whole range of things that we may or may not agree with. I don't like paying for tax breaks to fossil fuel companies. I don't like paying for for wars that we went into based on lies. But ultimately, taxes are how we as a society fund the most essential services that we can't individually bear the cost of, and that certainly can and should include health care. If we had a better healthcare social safety net, then we could see the need for abortion drastically reduced because everyone would have access to contraception. And in my view, that really should be the common ground. And it's unfortunate that here in Wisconsin, we have Republican efforts to criminalize birth control and to conflate it with abortion, rather than making sure that everyone who needs it has access to contraception and has the resources they need to parent if that's what they decide to do.
Perspective from Democratic State Senator Kelda Royce of Madison on politics at the state capitol. Call in with questions. What's on your mind? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Democratic State Senator Kelda Royce of Madison. Call in with questions, what you want lawmakers to know, especially now around budgeting priorities amid the historic surplus. You can join the discussion any point here, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. State Senator Royce, you sit on the Finance Committee that drafts the legislature's state budget, Joint Finance Committee. You're one of four Democrats on the 16-member committee. What is your top priority for getting through budget negotiations?
Well, there are so many great things in Governor Evers' budget that will help Wisconsin be a place where everyone can thrive. My priority is always kids. What is best for our kids? Everything from K-12 education, child care, to higher education. But I think, especially right now, we have got to do something about shared revenue. This is money that the state has promised to local governments, but for decades has not met its commitment. And that's why local governments are forced into these terrible binds of not being able to fund essential public services, you know, police, fire, clean water, and it's time for the state to fund their fair share and to have a permanent fix so that local communities can govern themselves without the kind of fiscal vice being put on them by state legislators.
The governor, in his plan, would envision 20% of state sales taxes to go to local governments to help in their funding. What do you think joint finance would be on board with?
I think that's an open question. I think, you know, the good news is that this is a problem that affects every community in the state, right? This is not a red or blue problem. This is not just Milwaukee and Madison or big cities. If you talk to Republican town board chairs all over the state, they're saying, hey, we don't have enough money to keep our roads paved. We got to turn them back to gravel. So I think Republican legislators do have an incentive here to come to the table and negotiate in good faith with Governor Evers, something that will help our local communities. I'm going to remain very open-minded and hopeful that we can get something done because this is certainly the time, both because of the dire financial position that our local governments are going to be in the next couple of years, and also because we do have an historic surplus that is in many ways funded because we have divested from the state's responsibilities to local governments for many years.
Yes, but Wisconsin Policy Forum laying it out, if Evers' budget were to be adopted in full, it would leave our state with a structural deficit, leaving it more difficult to balance the next state budget. Are you concerned about a large structural imbalance with all the things that want to be done with a historic surplus?
No, because Governor Evers' budget is fiscally responsible. It makes the kinds of critical investments that we have been lacking for decades. You know, in Wisconsin, we have been asking our schools, our teachers, the university, local governments to do more with less for decades. And, you know, they have done so admirably, but we have got to start making the kinds of investments that put us on equal and competitive footing with other states and that make Wisconsin a place where people want to start businesses and they want to raise their families. We are losing our best and brightest, and we can't continue to do that and expect that Wisconsin is going to be economically successful. So these are really important investments to make. And Governor Evers has put forth a balanced budget that is going to allow us to thrive in perpetuity because we will have more tax revenue. We will have more people in the workforce. We will have essential services covered. And all of those things are economically virtuous, meaning they will lead to even more economic activity. Mm-hmm. I know the Republicans are throwing out some dishonest numbers because they don't want to expand Medicaid, expand Badger Care, and that's going to cost Wisconsin taxpayers $1.6 billion. So yes, if you ignore the fact that Governor Evers wants to expand Medicaid, then yes, you can say we have a structural deficit, but that is by no means Governor Evers' fault. That one goes on the Republicans.
Talking state politics with Kel DeRoy's Democratic State Senator representing the 26th District in Madison. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. I want to just touch base here on these roundtable discussions as the budget comes together. Hearing from Wisconsinites directly, Finance Committee Democrats are holding separate public roundtable sessions to gather public information, public opinions. Why is that?
The Joint Finance Committee is only going to be holding four hearings around the state for everyone who lives in Wisconsin. And we felt that that really was not sufficient to give people a chance to make their voice heard on this very important budget. And none of those hearings are going to be held in the five largest cities in the state. So we wanted to have some additional hearings and give people, particularly in some of the larger cities that don't always get attention, like Milwaukee and Green Bay, a chance to make their voices heard as well.
You are a minority voice in the most powerful committee in state government. Do you feel like your voice is heard on children and family issues?
Well, Kate, one of the challenges in our legislature is that we are so deeply gerrymandered. But the thing that keeps me going is knowing that I represent the majority of the people in the state of Wisconsin. I hear from people who are represented by Republicans, and we try to respond to everyone who reaches out to our office. And they say, you know, I can't get a response from my Republican legislator. They just ignore me. But I really appreciate you standing out and, you know, speaking up for instance, LGBTQ teens and mental health care. And so I really feel a responsibility to make sure that I'm working in the best interest of the state and not just my constituents.
Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Kate. Thanks for the opportunity.
Democratic State Senator Kel DeRoys of Madison, first elected to the state Senate in 2020, served previously in the Assembly. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a question about education.
12 states that requires Native American content to be taught in schools. That prompted Maria Novotny to reach out to WPR's Wisconsin Project, asking us how educators are teaching this in the classroom. As WPR's Gabby Vinnick reports, schools are working to integrate Indigenous histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty into the curriculum.
In a Madison West High School classroom, students take their seats in their first period class. This morning, they're talking about news involving the Cherokee Nation and the push to have First Nation representation in Congress. One by one, students like senior Abby O'Callaghan share their questions.
Given the legacy of the federal government and its involvement in the dispossession of Native peoples, how can we move forward at both the local and the state level to kind of make sure that there's a real change in policy?
The class is just one example of how students are connecting the histories of Wisconsin's First Nations to the present day. And it wasn't too long ago that legislation known as Act 31 spurred this education. Since 1991, the law has mandated that public schools and public and private universities teach the histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty of tribal nations in Wisconsin. It was in response to the violence that erupted in northern Wisconsin in the 1980s. Members of the Ojibwe tribe were spearfishing, and protesters blocked them from exercising a treaty right they reserved. J.P. Leary is of Cherokee descent. He's an associate professor of First Nations Studies at UW-Green Bay. He wrote a book about Act 31.
The real policy problem that Act 31 is addressing is the lack of meaningful opportunities to learn accurate, authentic information about the federally recognized tribes and bands in Wisconsin.
David O'Connor agrees. He's a consultant at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. O'Connor is a member of the Ojibwe tribe and offers educators resources about Wisconsin's First Nations on topics like treaty rights, Indigenous languages, and festivities. He encourages educators to weave those lessons into subjects beyond social studies.
If you teach it from a tribal sovereignty lens first, you could teach Native histories and cultures 10 times easier.
Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized tribal nations. Teachers like Jeff Ryan of Prescott High School have been working to integrate Native histories more deeply into their lessons. Since 2000, the social studies teacher has taken hundreds of students on a four-day trip to the Lac du Flambeau Reservation in northern Wisconsin. They talk with tribal elders, do craft work, and tour cultural sites.
To gain a full understanding of the experience, whether it be the history or the contemporary issues connected to Native people, you have to access and talk with Native people.
There are more than 500 tribal nations in the U.S. Ryan and his students discuss what that means.
500 ways of thinking, 500 ways of talking, 500 ways of living, 500 ways of being.
Some critics say Act 31 has no teeth. The law requires the subject matter to be taught at least three times in grades K through 12. But since Wisconsin is a local control state, it's up to school boards and administrators to implement curriculum. Since its passage, more resources have become available for teachers to use. Even so, O'Connor says that for some educators, it's their first time learning the content. Sometimes it contradicts what they were taught.
For far too long, I always think that First Nations peoples and communities have been seen in curriculum as always long ago and far away, rather than being contemporary.
O'Connor says he hopes more schools make teaching Native histories a priority because, as he says, failing to do so is a lost opportunity for all.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on First Nations education in Wisconsin's classrooms. And the story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss caring for diabetes in the Hmong community and closing gaps in cultural understanding as some of the world's biggest insulin makers announce plans to slash the cost of some life-saving insulin products. You can join the conversation with questions and comments about the Hmong population in Wisconsin and healthcare, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Maisy Tao is director of the Hmong Studies Program and an assistant professor in anthropology at UW Oshkosh. Maisy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, let's start with your research into how trauma and displacement can affect the health of people, can affect the health of the Hmong community. What have you learned?
Yeah, so, you know, I started this work back as a graduate student, but a lot of this is also informed by my personal experience, right? So just seeing a lot of people who are Hmong with type 2 diabetes and none of that being documented in the data because of the, you know, assumption that Hmong people are also Asian. And so the kind of health disparities around diabetes didn't really get, it kind of gets invisibilized, right? And so in the work that I was doing, I started to find that Hmong folks do have indeed a high prevalence of type 2 diabetes. But also, you know, so as a medical anthropologist, right, so that means also I'm unpacking some of our taken for granted assumptions about things. So kind of challenging our ideas around diabetes. So most of the time we think of diabetes as something that you have to control individually, and that you have to maintain a healthy lifestyle so that you can have a good and long, healthy life. But, you know, what I was finding with the population that I was studying, and these are older Hmong adults, so who are around 50 to 60 and older, and experienced the war and refugee resettlement. And so what I was finding was that despite being very cognizant and aware of kind of the even our own medical cultural assumptions around diabetes, they became, you know, really they helped to understand the ways in which life in the U.S. actually isn't as conducive, right, to having a healthy life. So my interlocutors who I did my research with really talked about how life in the U.S. it was, you know, they were dealing with economic precarity, being laid off, ongoing forms of experience of social loss, right? Because either they can't speak English or they have to repurpose their labor, right, when the changing labor markets too. And so life post-resettlement for these refugees long-term has been something that was really difficult for them and really impacted diabetes.
Is this area that, as you talk about resettlement experiences of refugees, uprooting your life perhaps decades ago, is that historical trauma understudied in this area? Do you find that the research isn't there?
Yeah, well, I think in particular to the Hmong population, right, you know, we have a lot of literature in early resettlement time period for Hmong, but kind of following them along the lifespan is something that is new, you know, and I think, yeah, because, you know, when we think about the category of the refugee, we think of it mostly in terms of like the UN definition, right, of someone fleeing war. And so oftentimes our assumption is that the refugee is resettled so that they're okay, right, that their life is better. There's that handoff. And so my work is really bearing witness to what life after resettlement looks like.
Oh, because it almost feels like, well, you've resettled, done and dusted, you know, start a new chapter, move on. But that doesn't really have that effect on physical and mental health. You have seen across generations the repercussions of that resettlement.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, you know, when Hmong people were resettled, there were resettlement programs that were in place to help them and channel them into, you know, labor markets like the manufacturing and textile industry, right? But, you know, with the economic crash in 2008, a lot of these people were laid off, unemployed, right, as well as kind of the changing demands of the types of skills that people wanted to see, right? And so when you're dealing with a population that typically doesn't speak English as well, right? There isn't programs to help them repurpose their labor or repurpose their skills in order to find another job so that they could be economically stable. I think for me also, it's really important to highlight that refugees are oftentimes resettled into the kinds of landscape in the U.S., right? And so dealing with kind of the racial and economic inequality within the U.S., that, you know, refugees are predominantly put into places of high poverty and racial segregation. And so that also contributes to some of this stuff.
What can change in healthcare? How can healthcare providers better take into account different cultural experiences when providing care, when that nurse, that doctor, that medical provider may be a world away from that kind of trauma and strife and also may have language barriers?
Right. I think, you know, that's also something that I'm trying to think through more in my book manuscript. But I think what I find really enlightening in doing the research that I do is that my interlocutors have a really sharp understanding of biomedical culture, right? And so, but us as people who are immersed in biomedicine, right, as well as healthcare providers, like, we don't realize our own culture of medicine. And so they have a way of kind of articulating that, you know, medicine is oftentimes focused within the body, within the individual, and they're asking the provider to also bear witness to life outside of the body, right? To thinking about the social contexts that really shape and structure people to experience ongoing forms of displacement or also to be placed in a way that they then, you know, experience inequality, right? And so really asking healthcare providers to be reflective of kind of the culture in which they're part of, but also understanding how their patients' perspective can also be a lens into looking into our own culture and thinking about the things that we perhaps are taking for granted.
I think what you say there is a really beautiful way to make a case for narrative medicine and the importance of narrative medicine.
Mm-hmm.
UW Oshkosh medical anthropologist Maisie Tao with us on research into the health of an underserved population in Wisconsin and furthering scholarship in the Hmong Studies program. Call in with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have UW Oshkosh, Assistant Professor of Anthropology, head of its Hmong Studies program. Maisie Tao is here on research into cultural misunderstandings in an underserved community, her vision to deepen Hmong Studies into the college curriculum. Still time to join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. In 2020, you were named the head of UW Oshkosh's new Hmong Studies program. Tell us how this position came about.
Yeah, so I think there was a Hmong student, Cassie Shong, when she came onto campus, she wanted to see more curriculum that reflected herself, right? And so really trying to push the university to put on more Hmong Studies courses. And then there was an unfortunate racist incident on campus in 2018 that really kind of catapulted the creation of my position. And so, yeah, I think, you know, because of that, you know, I've been really trying to build a program in collaboration with Hmong students on this campus.
And as you create this program, what are your goals? What do you envision?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my vision for Hmong studies, I think, you know, for me, I think context is important. So Wisconsin, we have the third largest Hmong population in the entire U.S., and that Hmong is the third most spoken language in Wisconsin. And in the Fox Valley, where I'm situated, we have a really large sprawling Hmong community in the Fox Valley. And so for me, I want to really create Hmong studies as something that's dynamic, that's talking about issues of race, issues of power, issues of U.S. imperialism, like war, military expansion, right, in Southeast Asia. And so that students who come through the program actually have a really critical lens and are able to kind of then apply it, right, into the kinds of career that they will go into. So, like, you know, I get students who are majors in business, right, in healthcare, human services leadership, but really being able to think about issues of power and inequity through the lens of Hmong studies.
A college student might ask how Hmong studies would be relevant to them in their careers after graduation, and I would imagine you have confronted that before. What do you say in those situations?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Hmong studies is kind of a case study, right, in which we can think about larger issues. So for me, it allows us to think about refugee communities, right? It allows us to think about communities that have been displaced. But I think for me also, you know, like I came into the job in 2020 at the height of the COVID pandemic. Mm. And I taught my course called Memory and Trauma. And it was also really relevant to thinking about how a community experiences crisis and trauma, right? And dislocation and what, you know, being on virtual in the virtual platform. And it allows us kind of think about how have communities sustained themselves, right? What is their resiliency? What is their ability to heal and to name some of that? And so I think it was really healing for my students to go through that and think about that through a refugee community and then apply it to their life, right, currently in the COVID pandemic.
Kimberly from Arena called in, and Kimberly says, there's this book called The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. It's the narrative of a young Hmong refugee child dealing with epilepsy in the U.S. healthcare system. Kimberly's wondering if you've read the book, encountered it, and wants to know how your studies are similar or different from the book's story.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up. Yeah, so this book has shaped a lot of American medical education as well as education in higher ed. But the book is fairly problematic in how it represents Hmong people as like cultural or primitive and stubborn. And so my work is really contesting and challenging this book, right, to really highlighting Hmong ways of knowing is actually legitimate, right, and also allowing us to think critically about medicine, but also to talk about how people perhaps even experience racism in medicine too, right? And so kind of talking about that kind of complexity. And so my work is, it is in itself a push against this book.
How do you talk about the book in your coursework at all? Does it come up?
Yeah, so in my course, I actually don't teach the book because mm-hmm. I think sometimes that it has too much harm for me to undo. Mm-hmm. But we do talk about some of the excerpts and about thinking about culture, right? Thinking about who gets represented as cultural and who gets represented as acultural, right? Who possesses culture and doesn't, right? And oftentimes those are along the lines of racialization, right? And so when you racialize somebody as cultural, you're making them very visibly, right, cultural, and that's the way you come to understand them. And so, like, within Hmong studies, like, for me, it's also unsettling this idea of culture to say, you know, Hmong people are people, right, and that they are complex and they're contradictory, just like all of us. Like, this is about, you know, this is about humans, too. So it's not about just culture, right, talking about the complexity of what it means to be human. And so, you know, my students do an analysis of culture, even as it, you know, how Hmong people are represented even in mainstream media like Grey's Anatomy, Doogie Howser, right? And so they're able to say, oh, wow, this is how this narrative of culture, the way that Fadiman creates, right, really is showcased over and over again, even in, you know, in the media.
Eye-opening as well outside in so many different aspects. Talking about the Hmong Studies program at UW Oshkosh with its program director, Maisy Tao, medical anthropologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maisy, how could Hmong Studies be incorporated into more fields of study in the future? What do you envision there?
Yeah, so, you know, I think Hmong Studies for me at Oshkosh, I think I speak for that. I think in general, I think Hmong Studies actually is very interdisciplinary, right? So it grew out of anthropology. You have it, you know, being developed by scholars in sociology, right, in education policy, research, in history. And so it's very interdisciplinary in nature. And so I think that, you know, having curriculum that draws on Hmong Studies really helps to kind of nuance the curriculum, right, in the ways that our students are able to understand, you know, some of the various disciplines that we come from. And so at the university, for me, I'm really interested in growing Hmong Studies, you know, into, you know, our College of Education, into a College of Nursing. Currently, it's in College of Arts and Science, but really giving people, you know, a nuanced perspective of the population, but also to understand that allows us to think about what it means to work in a growing, diverse world, right?
How could academia be more supportive of Hmong history and culture and research?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm very lucky to say that my university has been really supportive. We recently were able to hire two new Hmong Studies faculty who will be joining me in the fall, which is actually history in the making. You know, never before have we ever had a Hmong Studies program that has had more than one faculty. And so this is kind of where the support has come, is at, you know, the personnel. And then also, you know, just recently was in a conversation with the chancellor and the provost with community members to think about the applied aspect of Hmong Studies and branching it out into the community. And I think that's why here at UWO makes it so conducive to do that, because UWO is very much invested in thinking about community engagement.
Maisy Tao, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Maisy Tao, Director of the Hmong Studies Program and Assistant Professor of Anthropology at UW Oshkosh. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.